Welcome to the Healing Trauma Podcast, the Faith Edition, where your healing and faith journey matters. Where faith and trauma-informed healing unite in safety, empathy, and compassion. Now here is your host, Monique Coven.
I'm so excited for this conversation. I want to welcome Dr. Dan Allender and Kathy Lorzel. Your work has been so profound in my own life when it comes to trauma healing. When I started reading your work, I was like, I feel like I've touched gold. And not only feel it, I've experienced some of this work myself. And so I'm very passionate about it. I couldn't wait to get you guys on to start talking about why this is such wonderful work. Also, I wanted to talk about your book, which is like the best title ever, Redeeming Heartache. Is there another portion to it, or is it just Redeeming Heartache?
The frightening thing is I sometimes barely remember the major title, but I would be hard pressed ever to come up to the subtitle. What is the subtitle, Kathy?
It's How Past Suffering Reveals Our True Calling.
That's big. That's actually huge. But the topic of redeeming heartache, I mean, many of us, I know for myself, before I started getting into this work, I thought, well, I guess this is it. I guess the best I can do is kind of try to regulate my nervous system and come back to the present moment. But I'm still carrying a lot of those wounds of the fact that I was not witnessed over and over and over again. I had people turn the other way and leave. Mm-hmm. And as much as I want to say or act like it doesn't impact me, I think about it and it impacts me every day. And so just this idea of coming back to your past or your heartache, I mean, on the one hand, it's very frightening to go back. Ooh, what do you mean? We have to talk about that. But on the other hand, this is what you talk about, which is bringing it back in a way that invites redemption. And how that can really impact us. So maybe we could start with just talking about this concept of why is that important when it comes to trauma?
I love the quote from Faulkner in A Requiem for a Nun, where he has this brilliant, simple sentence where he says, the past is never finished. It's not even in the past. And so when you begin to go, we know far more neurologically that the realities of what we have endured and suffered continue to play out in a kind of traumatic response to the past, but living in the present. And so it's such a simple beginning to say that if we won't deal with the past, we will have no deep influence for shaping the present into the future.
So I have two kids. I have a 7-year-old and a 10-year-old, and I'm constantly thinking about how our present right now is going to impact their future, right? You know, because you can see it in their little minds. They're taking in all of our interactions, all of our engagements, and that's showing them what's true about the world. At every dinner. You know, and that's a lot of pressure for parents, right? So for those of us who are raising kids right now actively, it's okay. All of us have to deal with it. But they're encoding the world based on their experiences right now. And those are the things that they will automatically rely upon in the future to decide what's going on. And if they're safe, if they're not safe, if they're okay, what's going to happen next. We use our predictive experiences as when we're younger to help us survive and then deal with the present. That's what we're built to do. It's a brilliant way that our minds are designed. The problem is when things happen that are difficult in our past, those will automatically jump to our future and influence how we handle things. So when you talked about regulating your nervous system, right? your nervous system is not only relating to the current, but it's pulling from the past to say, how do I engage with this in order to keep myself safe? Mm-hmm. And so, you know, people think of like going back to past trauma, it's indulgent, or navel gazing, especially in the church, right? You know, like, can't we just move on? And I wish we could, but it's just not how we're built neurobiologically.
That's right. That's right. And that's a very important piece that I want to bring forward. I was talking to Dr. Allison Cook a couple of days ago, and, you know, she was saying like, that's like the worst thing we could tell a trauma survivor, the worst, you know? So I want to just understand how important it is to engage what we're feeling and not, you know, just push it away, because we did that our entire life as trauma survivors, right? Mm-hmm. So we don't want to continue doing that. So that's really, really good what you just shared, Kathy, about how that works. So why then is this work of coming back to our stories now in the present and redeeming it and looking at it and working with it, or your terminology, which was the first time I heard it, engaging your mm-hmm. story? Why is that important in the healing journey?
Well, it start with the fact that with every story of trauma, the very nature of trauma at its core is a form of fragmentation. And we know enough about the left frontal lobe in terms of when we're in trauma. One of the things that goes offline is Broca's area, which is what essentially manages language. And so our memory of what occurred is already fragmented. No one remembers a traumatic event with an abundance of clarity and sequentiality. It's going to be, in one sense, fragmented with shards, with sensations, with some degree of perhaps scenes, but not really the beginning, middle, and the end. And so when we begin to talk about engaging your memory, your story of the past, we have to begin with that notion that it's not going to be a simple process, that we have to honor what we do know and honor it without, and to me, this is a key phrase, without bias. And most of us come to our memories of trauma with judgments about that 8-year-old girl who yeah. should have known better than going to the neighbor's house where terrible things happened. Well, the judgments you make are a bias that keep you from being able to feel, see, and find a certain continuity and wholeness to the narrative itself. So we can't come to our story individually, isolated, alone, and expect that if we sit in a room with a journal, we'll just be able to write it out, come to terms with it, and be able to go, well, that's in the past, I'm going to move on. That's not how we engage. And that's why your word and hearing the word engagement, it means I got to listen to my own story. I got to know that every time I come back to the story 5, 10, 20 or more times, I'm going to have a clearer, deeper, and in many ways, more emotionally affected presence with that story. And in that, we begin to, in one sense, come to seeing how the whole plays out, as Kathy put so well, in terms of how we engage in the present and the future.
I also heard you say something that really struck me in a YouTube video where you were talking about trauma's impact. So good. And you said something profound. You said, what we remember is how we interpreted the story, and that's how what we remember. So if I remember everybody walked away because I'm disgusting, that's going to be my story, and that's the impact that it's going to have.
Yeah. Yeah. And just that word, disgusting,
yeah.
is I don't mean to be unkind as I put it, it's a violent, degrading, yeah. contemptuous word.
Absolutely.
And most of us, when we look at almost any level of our trauma, we come with that judgment mm-hmm. of some form of contempt, which keeps us not only from having the story, but being able to see how that story really played out for us.
Mm-hmm. Yes. Mm-hmm. Yeah. And it makes so much sense when you said, we can't sit there with journals by ourselves because I know I've tried it in the past. I'm going to go and say, okay, I'll be compassionate. It was like an eggshell, like, no, eggshell can crack, a wall, you know, it's like, couldn't relate, you know, it's kind of like when you try to be compassionate or have self-compassion when you've never, it's like a different language. What were you going to say, Kathy?
Oh, well, I mean, I love the analogy of being nose blind to our own stories. Mm. And so I was gone for a couple of days and came back to my house. And I don't know if you've experienced this before, but when you walk into your house, the first hour after you've been gone for a while is when you can really smell what it smells like. And my house is filled with dogs and kids and it's not a great smell. And so when I walk back in after being gone for 4 days, I'm like, wow, this is problematic. And I know I have about, you know, 6 hours where I'm going to smell it for real before I go nose blind to it again, because that's just, that's what we do. And so I quickly go through and figure out where all the smells are coming from, and usually has something to do with urine and dog hair, but you know, that's just, that's what I live in. You know, and I think that's true for our stories. We normalize what we live in, and we don't know what it should have looked like, nor can we really understand that without that breaking our hearts in a way that we can't recover from when we're little. You can't understand what a family really should be like when you're in the middle of abuse and trauma or neglect. And so we normalize it. We get nose blind to our stories. And so when we sit with someone else, or we engage our story, or someone else engages our story, we all of a sudden start to smell it. And usually we'll smell it because we're sitting with someone who's going, wow, that is really hard. Or all of a sudden they have tears and you can see in their face like, wow, that wasn't normal. That's not what other parents were doing, right? And so, you know, the theory behind story work is that our best approach to being able to go in and understand where trauma happened, where heartache embedded itself in our lives, is not just through like a brush over of like, yeah, you know, my parents were mean. Right. Well, you can say that, and someone else can say, wow, I'm really sorry you had such mean parents. Right. But that's not actually getting to the smell and the grit of the story. And that doesn't help you understand how it impacted you, what it felt like to be in the room, what you had to ignore, what you had to bear. And often, and you know, you said this, you need a witness. You need someone else with you in the room to say, oh gosh, this is, not only is this bad, but it's far worse than you thought. And when our bodies can drop into that place, we can actually heal what was broken back then. You can heal it in the present, but it stays broken if it just kind of stays swept under the rug and unexposed. And that's very difficult, delicate work that a lot of people really are afraid of, because it feels like it's going to be very painful. And it is. But what they don't realize is that once you start to uncover it, there's the healing is actually brings far more joy, far more life. Even the grief over it can bring a degree of life. And that's why we continue to encourage people to engage and to lean into what are the stories that broke your heart that you haven't had a witness to and haven't been able to actually approach and talk of the nuance of how did it smell? And can we be with you in that story?
I mean, I could feel it in my body as you're speaking, how I could cry, because I will cry. Stop it. No, because it's so touching, because that's exactly what happened. I'll speak for myself, but I mean, I've spoken to, you know, so many survivors, is that we were alone in it over and over and over again. And I had people like look the other way, and I needed the just look at me. I was trying to engage and get, and I thought I was going to go to my grave with never having the eye contact and the compassion and the idea. That's why I'm like, Dan, how did you think this? The idea of having a group of kind eyes looking back at you with the same story that harmed you and impacted you in your life. I don't have words. It's just so impactful.
Well, I know one of the great gifts for me as a therapist is, you know, I did a lot of education, which I'm very grateful for. But the real education came from hearing people talk about their life and having people with courage to step into the effects of past sexual abuse, the reality of a cruel mom and yet a very passive but pleasant, kind father. I mean, all the iterations of the complexity of the human condition, when you begin to step in, it is such a, if we can say these two words, so much brokenness and so much beauty. Every one of us reflects something of the divine, of God, of the universe, in a way in which we are ourselves, but we're also more than ourselves. Yet, as Kathy put it, it's like we, when we have been harmed, our escape route virtually always is in some sense to do more harm to ourselves. So we iterate and pile up the debris of our own addictions, or we pile up our own defensiveness, which only recreates some of the same structure of loneliness that we had when we were abused. And you go, all the efforts are honorable and often imaginative, but they often fail to address the one key word that you used, and that's the idea of kindness. How kind are you to that four-year-old boy or girl who so desperately just wanted someone to notice that they were funny, that they were really playful and cute, and yet the efforts to invite, see me, mm-hmm. brought an abuser into the room. Mm-hmm. So what we then do with our, you know, putative efforts of making bids to the universe, will you delight in me? Set me up then for the harm that was perpetrated. How does a four-year-old, how does an 8 or 12 or frankly even sometimes a 42-year-old actually discern, I was being groomed, I was being set up, I was being abandoned? And in all that, there were those who did harm, and they did it knowingly and often brilliantly. I'm left with the debris at some level thinking, it is my desire, it is my heart's setup that somehow is the cause of the harm. Mm-hmm. And so if we can disrupt contempt, if we can disrupt the biased judgment that we've often been seduced to hold against ourselves, it can only come because someone has stood and told us the truth, but they've done so with a kind face, not nice. And make sure that you make a keen distinction between niceness, which is essentially an avoidance of conflict, but kindness, which has that ferocity of doing good on your behalf. Yeah. That is what opens the heart to significant change.
Yes, mm-hmm. yes, yes, yes. You talked about the lady in the grocery store and how, you know, just about like you were in a state of trauma and how you lost your words and she was just kind to you. And I was like, I was listening and I was so moved. I think I was crying. It was just so touching, but that's again, that's exactly it. So how then, you talked about trying to break through the contempt and that how difficult really to do it on our own. So how do you see that happening in, let's say, you know, the ways that you describe story work? And
the reason that we created the Allender Center, gosh, I don't even know how many years ago, Dan.
I think it was 70, because we do things in dog years.
Dog years. I think I got married the same year the Allender Center officially launched. And so it's like 13 years now that we, since the Allender Center was officially launched. But before that, you know, Dan, you were doing story work because you started the Seattle School of Theology and Psychology. And even prior to that, you were doing Recovery Week. So this has been something, Dan, that you saw a long time ago, the need for it, the need to be able to speak your stories, and even more than just the therapeutic engagement, the idea of actually reading your story and how powerful that is. And then even a group being around you as a witness with a facilitator. And this has been a practice that you've been doing for 40.
Oh, don't age me, but yes.
Oh,
I would say about, About 47 years, something
47.
Broadly speaking in that. Yeah.
Yeah. I knew it was older than me.
But it essentially it's what every community, I mean, whether it's the church or whether it's an indigenous peoples group, we have known, maybe without full understanding of the neurological process, but we all need co-regulation. And so just as an 8-month-old or even younger or older needs the face, needs mm-hmm. the presence mm-hmm. of another limbic system holding care in that form of attunement and containment. So I would say it certainly we have been doing it for a long season and made a host of mistakes and stumbled into a bit of wisdom. But people need people to heal. But now it's not just the macaroni dish that gets delivered after a great loss in your life. That's good. But it's, will you step into what most people fear to tread, to my anger, to my grief, to my shame? And because I'm already traumatized, the thought that somebody could just trammel those deep and raw parts of me, we are highly protective. And so we really do need to be with people, but with people who know how to do good story work, who have in one sense allowed themselves to do the work on behalf of their own life that indeed then gives them the context to be able to do so with others. Mm-hmm. So be it a good story guide, be a good therapist, be a good rabbi, be a good pastor, be just a good plumber. We're talking about the kind of person who can hold your story with anger and grief mm-hmm. and invite you into the fragmentation so that there is a beginning coherence. Mm-hmm. Because meaning will not come without some degree of coherence. And we need to know not so much why something mm-hmm. occurred, but what is it meant to bring? What is it meant to bring me to be and to become? That's the hard work that indeed holds the past with the risk of the future, but dealt with a kind of co-regulating present.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Would you like to explain what co-regulation is? Because some people may not actually know what that is.
Well, Kathy's got dogs. Ours died years ago. We have children and grandchildren, but they don't live here. So I'm going to turn it over to my brilliant colleague.
Oh, pass the ball. My dog is literally laying right next to me.
Yeah, so is mine.
I mean, co-regulation. So we have limbic systems. We have a right brain where we can connect to people's energy, to their neurobiology, to the essence of what they're offering with their bodies. And all co-regulation is the fact that when we settle, it offers someone else the capacity to settle too.
Yeah.
And so, you know, those of you who have had children or pets, right? When you hold a baby who is dysregulated and you calm your own body down, the baby will hopefully calm down as well as you rock, as you sing, as you speak, as you offer a tender, soft body and mm-hmm. warmth, you know, that's co-regulation. And so, but as a baby does that, you can notice your body will settle as well. And so there's a back and forth, there's a dance that happens between people and you can regulate yourself without another person. There are ways to do that, but our bodies are wired for connection.
Yes.
And so, you know, even there's now science that says you can stare or hug a dog for 2 minutes and it can regulate your body.
I believe that.
Me too.
I'd say even a minute.
Yeah. That's right.
Yeah, totally. Yeah. Totally. And so, you know, the idea of like a group of people, so co-regulating with a group of kind faces, engaging in your story and offering their how they see it. You know, I experienced that and I got to watch it happening to someone else. Just last night, actually. And, you know, just it's so profound to see some people responding to someone else's story angry, like that shouldn't have happened. And, you know, so the justice, the anger, and then another person, like, you know, crying, you know, that how could that happen to a, you know, a child? I'm so sorry that happened to you. That should have never happened to you. And just, you know, the tenderness and offering words of love for that child. I mean, it's just the most beautiful thing. And it's what I call, it's for the nervous system. It's that disconfirming experience that we so need. And I now believe that with enough repetitions of this, that it can change your nervous system.
Oh, because absolutely.
You start to expect, like, oh, wow. Like, you just probably feel things a little bit differently. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. And that stability is what we mean as the launching pad to begin to explore meaning. And when I say meaning, I don't mean why did this occur, because there's never an explanation, no matter what theology, whatever view of life, there's not a causative understanding that because X, Y occurred. Right. But the larger sense of we've got to disrupt the very means by which we survived. Honoring it is beautiful. And yet it often creates within us structures of numbness, distraction, dependency, addiction, etc. Or we push people away, or we become people who fawn and demand connection in a way that makes sense if we enter the trauma, but we've got to disrupt the debris that's come from our own effort to find life on our own. And that becomes a whole new dimension. There are a lot of people who do story work where you do have the witness and you need it as a foundation. From our standpoint, you got to go further. And that is, you got to explore what has this harm brought you in the way you relate to other people. Because our relational style is often this intersection, again, of something deeply broken, but also something stunningly beautiful. Can we hold both together, honor and grieve simultaneously? If so, we've begun to now gain meaning as to how this harm has shaped the way we begin and engage relationships.
I just got off a plane Sunday night from an engagement in Nashville. And coming home for me is a tricky place where a lot of, and so Dan, what you're describing is style of relating, right? So when we experience something in our past, it shapes how we then engage the world. And if bad things happen, we then get maladaptive behaviors that were adaptive back then, right? They're needed in order to survive. And now they're not serving us well. Brené Brown talks about this all the time, right? We armor up, but now our armor is no longer serving us. And so for us to start to understand, so for me, when I come home, I do not want to engage. I'll engage my kids. I'm kind. I come back in, but because I've been dysregulated, I've been caring for other people's stories. I'm exhausted. I do not want to engage my husband, right? I'm shut down. I'm curt. I'm cold. Mm-hmm. And we've been married for 13 years. So we've worked through this. I know this about myself. He knows this about me, but this is a trauma response, right? This is because of this part of me that I've armored up, because my assumption is that when I'm tired and exhausted and have gone through something, engaging with someone else is not going to be helpful. Mm-hmm. My nervous system is telling me to engage with someone else means hurt, or being misunderstood or mishandled. And so it is better for me to close up, to isolate, and to recover on my own. And then when I feel okay, I'll come back out and re-engage, right? But my instinct, my trauma instinct is to isolate. Mm-hmm. And so for us coming back, it's this dance where I know that about myself. He knows that about me. He knows why. I know why. But it's still a fight every time you come back into the room, right? And so I, you know, and we're still, he's like, how you doing? I'm like, pretty prickly, you know, It's like, anything I could do. I'm like, I don't know. Can you maybe just clean the kitchen? Like, you know, that's where we are right now. And he's like, okay, you know, and so we do this and then we warm up. And my job is to be aware of myself and to come back into relationship, to deal with my nervous system, to allow myself to be attended to by him. And his job is to then, with kindness and generosity, allow me to kind of do the move back and forth between us and hold on to our relationship and allow there to be a coming back together. Now that in the past, that has not gone well when we have not been aware of what's actually playing out between us, right? That could be a big instigator of some pretty big fights. And it has been. But I think the more you do story work and why you can't just stop with the what happened to me, why you then have to go to, and how is that impacting me now in how I relate to the people around me who love me and want to connect, but where am I still holding myself back? Because then that becomes my responsibility to both heal and grieve why I have that reaction, right? Because that comes from harm, but then have responsibility in the present to say, okay, I have to now be aware of myself. Yeah. I have a role to play in this. I can't just allow myself to come in and, you know, be angry and volatile or dissociative and isolated, right? I actually have to tend to my body and then be allowed to be connected to.
From my standpoint, what Kathy's putting brilliant words to is she operates, like many of us do, like an orphan. And what we did in the book Redeeming Heartache is we took three archetypes from the Hebrew Bible that essentially are summative of the kind of trauma you're likely going to know in this life: to be an orphan, to be a stranger, and to be a widow or a widower. And in that sense of you've lost your name, you've lost your place, or you've lost community and you're a stranger, or you've lost love and you're a widow. So when you begin to look at the archetypes, they are so common. And you begin to go, well, orphan responses are fairly, again, universal and predictable. So are stranger responses, and in many ways, widow responses. So part of our task is, can we name our trauma, look at the lens, and this is just one lens of many, to look through those archetypes and begin to get a better sense of how have we attempted, again, going back to Brené Brown's term, how have we armored up that actually has created even new wounds for us. And that's the hard part. It isn't just looking at our past. Mm-hmm. It's looking at our past present.
Yeah.
Our past present is where we're living out things that actually continue to bring the debris of the trauma into the present until we begin to disrupt it. But you can't disrupt what you're not aware of. And right. What Kathy just put words to is incredible, accurate orphan response.
I love that, because what you did was you named what's happening. You named it for yourself. You named it for your husband. And when we start to name things, we don't feel as out of control because it's named. So I really love that. And I relate it to what you were saying. I'm going, yeah, I go into dorsal a lot and I just will shut down and like, keep your distance. And of course, as orphans, that's what we learned. We're by ourselves. We shut down. Some of us, like myself, sometimes just don't want to look at it because it's a lot of work, you know?
It is a lot of work.
Yeah.
But the problem is when you don't look at it, right? Then you have these relational dynamics that are going on, you know, and more often when people end up, you know, in my office or Dan's office or with a therapist, it's because they're having these relational issues between the people that they're trying to love, either with their kids or spouse or partners or churches, you know, and so we're often very not popular because it's like, hey, you know, yes, this is going on right now, but we can't fix that without understanding what you're reacting to. What's the original wound that you've armored up against? And once you start to look at it that way, it makes a lot of sense that you have to go back. You know, but again, we're very resistant to wanting to do that because we want a quick fix and we want someone to just say, okay, you know, do this 5-step program and you know, let's and figure out how to have these different habits, and then you can fix your relationship. And it doesn't work that way.
So comparable to how many people use a credit card. You know, I'm going to pay later. But the bottom line is, you're going to pay. You're going to pay now, or you're going to pay later. And when you pay later, I just had a friend who went in to help her son, who's 19, to get a car loan. And they offered him the rate of 23%. And you go, oh, my goodness. That's beyond, I mean, it's almost mob level usury. But it's like, well, we're inviting you. Will you step in with a good story guide to engage realities that have a trajectory, an arc into the way your marriage is going, the way you relate to your children, how you eat, how you drive? I mean, there's not a single iota of our life that does not have a kind of shaping due to what we've not addressed with regard to our lives. And again, I think we've all acknowledged there's a lot of pain in that. But, you know, if you need to go to the dentist, wait 10 years and then go, oh my gosh, it is going to be a long week for you. And but when you step in, even with small, and I'll put it in this language, small bites, small, like take one story. Begin to do some writing. And even if you've only got a friend you know will be just empathetic, just to be able to read a paragraph or two and be able to say, what do you think this tells you about how I've lived my life? What do you think, because you know me, where do you see this being lived out in terms of how I was when I was 12 and now that I'm 42? What do you do with what I've written? And even if they're not trained, but they're courageous and kind, what you begin to get is data that you did not have before. But that's why we keep coming back to, can we talk about being an orphan and a stranger and a widow? Because it gives you language to begin the process of being able to look through the archetype at some of the structures that you've lived with that you might just go, oh, it's just normal. Mm-hmm. And you go, normal for a highly traumatized person, but not normal from the standpoint of what your creator made you to be and to do.
I have something that I want to bring up, because I'm thinking maybe some of the audience might be thinking this. Of course, you know, with the podcast, I was talking to all different kinds of people with different modalities. And to be honest, I was kind of told that don't do story, because story work, when you start to talk about trauma, you become dysregulated and you go offline. And you know, I took that and I didn't go any further, but you've explained it well. I heard you talk about it. Could you share with us how stories work where that does not happen? You have safeguards.
I think the first and the foremost is, do you know when your body cannot bear anymore? Mm-hmm. It's kind of like, you know, the more positive side is, it's a big Thanksgiving Day meal, but you just can't eat anymore and still bear any sense of goodness. So we need to come to our stories with an awareness that just pushing through does not bear honor and goodness. But can we take what we can take and begin that process of digesting, of metabolizing, and being able to go, what does this invite me to? So learning how to breathe, though that may sound really simple, learning how to tend to your body when you're beginning to feel dysregulated. Literally, do you know how good rocking is? Do you know what it is to go side to side or backwards and forwards? You know, in the Jewish community, it's called davening. Before the Western Wall, that movement of forward and back, it is a regulation. Mm-hmm. It is a co-regulation that allows your body to take in with kindness rather than, again, the abruptness, the harshness, the demand, like get it over with.
I think regulation has become a catchphrase. And that may sound disparaging. I don't mean it that way because I use it all the time. But you can do really good work and be agitated. Well, you know, and so if you look at the spectrum of zero is dead. 10 is you've lost your mind and you're off the rails, right? There's a decent range in there where good work can still happen. And I think now we're so afraid of feeling it that we avoid some of these stories because we're so terrified of re-traumatizing ourselves or re-traumatizing others. But I actually think, you know, and so if you understand your line, like, you know, if you're at a seven, and that means you're on the right at the edge of being pretty dysregulated and hyper aroused, and you're starting to kind of like hyperventilate. Well, you can bring yourself to that line and then learn how to breathe, learn how to hold the feeling that you're so terrified of feeling in that moment that's causing the dysregulation. And then you can actually do, and this is what I call, talk to clients all the time, I call it a controlled descent. And so we're not going to throw you into a trauma story and just get you up to a 10 and then leave you, right? But we're also not going to avoid the stories that are difficult, because that's what our parents did. Mm-hmm. That's what that's why the trauma is there in the first place, is because no one was willing to look at it. Mm-hmm. No one was willing to be with us and say, I know this is really hard and your body is starting to escalate. So let's bring it back down and breathe. And then let's see, you know, is it kinder to stop? Once you regulate, is there more room now to keep telling the story? But we don't want to ignore the story just to stay regulated.
It's often referred to as the window of tolerance, knowing that there are certain moments where, you know, the process of just almost freezing, where we're just so numb, we can't move. Well, anytime you're getting in that 1, 2, 3, 4 range, you need to like splash cold water on your face. I mean, you need to reset your vagal nerve by a number of techniques that can be learned. But what most people do is get hyper aroused. And that's where we go back to, this is really not work you're meant to be doing exclusively alone. Oh, there's a lot of work you can do alone, and you're meant to, but it's not meant to be primarily alone, because you need that ability for somebody to say, I think you need to just put your feet on the floor, take a very deep breath, and let's do 3 or 4 deep breaths, exhales, etc. And it's amazing how in fairly brief processes our bodies restore, at least begin to restore.
That's really, really good. I wanted to talk about the last thing, which is so interesting in your work, is that I've read and you talk about in the book that our traumas can actually point to where our calling is. Mm-hmm. Do you want to say something about that?
Well, it's a radical and almost crazy thought, but it takes the core notion that, you know, what doesn't kill you will make you stronger. I there's truth to that. And Nietzsche was brilliant as he put words to it. But the strength Nietzsche is talking about is a kind of I will survive versus I will thrive. And that process of saying, where we have known harm, we are meant to know not just healing, but gifting, a kind of gifting for ourselves with surprise, where mercy, where kindness, where anger and righteousness and justice begin to play out. So our healing ought to, in many ways, shock us with a kind of like, I didn't know I needed that, but I do. But what we receive, I don't think there's any better way to put it, we're meant to give away. Not the first day, week, month, maybe not even the first year or two, but where we receive, it is a gift that is meant to mature us. And as it matures us, we're meant to eventually give it away. In that sense, your calling, we put it in language of heaven and hell. You're meant to put your neck on the neck of evil, and in some sense say, hell no. But you're meant to also say, I'm meant to create beauty, true, sweet goodness and beauty on this earth, heaven, yes. So when you hold the reality of there is evil and there is goodness. I want to stand against one. I want to co-create with others something of that goodness of what in what's called the Lord's Prayer, when people pray on earth as it is in heaven, what we're ultimately saying is we can bring something of the goodness of eternity into the present reality of an unjust and cruel world. Will it change everything? Of course not. Will it change something? More importantly, it will change someone.
It's so beautiful.
And I think more when we look at calling, right, it's about what has our story uniquely set us apart to be able to understand about the world. And then we're uniquely able to see it and do something about it in a different way. And, you know, I was just meeting with someone who has this incredible capacity, almost like an Annie Dillard. I don't know if you know that, that she writes about the natural world, and the way she's able to see the natural world is just stunning. And because of this person's trauma, they are able to see the beauty and the intricacy of the natural world in a way that brings tears to my eyes whenever she reads what she's written. Right. Well, that's directly related to the heartache of what she experienced that brought her life and her heart outside in order to find the beauty that she was so needing because of the coldness that was in her home. Mm-hmm. Right. And so now this woman has this incredible gift and capacity to see the natural world and bring us into it in a way that brings life and beauty and heartache of how glorious it is, right? In a way that someone who hadn't experienced her trauma would never be able to do. And so we're not saying, you know, that somehow this is all on purpose. It's that sense that what has happened to you will mark you, but also it will prepare you to maybe bring healing in the very thing that brought such harm to you. And what a redemptive arc that is.
Mm-hmm. Oh, incredible. Incredible. Mm-hmm. Oh, so beautiful. So, I mean, I'm sure I'm going to want to have you guys back again because there's so much more to talk about, but I love it. And I see the book in the back. Do you want to just maybe show us the book, the cover?
Sure.
Yeah. Redeeming Heartache. I loved it. Thank you. Thank you guys for being here.
Thank you for having us.
Such an honor. Thank you so much.